content of this program is for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. We will begin today with The American West is quietly having a terrible fire season. This story written by Nancy Walecki. The summer of 2026 has been one of extraordinary fires. In Europe, they have burned hundreds of thousands of acres in France and Spain and destroyed homes across England. They killed 13 people in Spain last month and an elderly couple in Greece this weekend. In Canada, fires have consumed an expanse of forest land larger than Belgium, which is also battling its biggest recorded wildfire. In the United States, about 7.2 million acres have burned, the largest year-to-date area in the past decade, and nearly double what it was at this time last year, according to data from the National Interagency Coordination Center. Allison Rayburn, a program coordinator for the Oregon Department of Forestry, told me that in the eastern part of the state, you can barely see the sun through the smoke. It's just devastation and miles and miles and miles of blackened landscapes. In Europe, many of the fires have threatened populated areas, but in the U.S., much of the area burning in the west has been rural. Near the Oregon town of Jordan Valley, the Big Grass Fire has been burning since July 23rd and is among the largest fires in the state's modern history. Toward the end of last month, it hopped a canyon and crossed the border into Idaho, where the smoke from this and other fires made the air quality the worst in the country. The complex of fires in Spokane, Washington, flattened entire neighborhoods. Three other wildfires 10 times its size are burning elsewhere in the state. If 2025 was a year of urban fire that destroyed large swaths of Los Angeles, 2026 is a year of rural fire. Daniel Swain, a climate scientist at the University of California Agriculture and Natural Resources Research Unit, told me. "This is an extraordinary fire season in the American West," Swain said. "It just hasn't been in California, which usually accounts for much of the nation's fire activity and its media attention. Many of the biggest fires this year started because of back-to-back lightning strikes and have grown because of extreme heat, drought, and dry fuel left behind after an unusually warm winter. They've destroyed grazing land and crops, killed livestock, and incinerated fruit that was just shy of harvest. Many of the ranchers and government employees I spoke with compared 2026 to Oregon's devastating fire season 2 years ago, when 1.9 million acres burned across the state. Already this year, residents have lost hundreds of thousands more acres than that. When I spoke with Dave Upthegrove, Washington's Commissioner of Public Lands, he was driving from the fires in Spokane to one near Walla Walla that was threatening the town's water supply. The week before, he'd visited the burn area of the 150,000-acre Sinlahican Fire. Firefighters there have used a road as a fire lane, he said, and on one side of it was all flat and black. On the other side, crops were wilting from the fire's heat. Because so many fires this year are burning on rugged terrain without many roads, the elite firefighters who rappel from helicopters and hike through miles of forests to reach a fire line have been in high demand, Upthegrove said. But these hotshot crews cannot hit every fire, and in many cases, ranchers are the first to get there. Silas Skinner, a sixth-generation cattle rancher, told me that when the Big Grass Fire broke out, three government trucks were there. The rest were rigs from the Jordan Valley Rangeland Fire Protection Association, RFPAs, about 40 of which are spread across Oregon, Idaho, and Nevada, are independent, volunteer firefighting nonprofits composed of local ranchers and farmers who are trained by state and federal agencies to help fill the firefighting gap in rural areas. Their equipment comes largely from military surplus, literally, in some cases, bulldozers that didn't get sent to Vietnam, and some that did, Rayburn, who is one of the RFPA's main contacts in the Oregon government, said. In the week since lightning struck and started the fire, Skinner and about 100 other volunteers have been using military trucks outfitted with water tanks and sprayers to help government agencies fight the big grass fire. It is currently burning an expanse of sagebrush and juniper trees nearly the size of Luxembourg. Federal agencies have also been sending in thousands of employees to fight the fires. But with so many fires burning simultaneously, government resources have been stretched thin and diverted to those in more populated areas, such as Spokane. The volunteer firefighters, then, have taken on more of a share of the work than they have in the past, they told me. Both the Forest Service and Wildland Fire Service said that it's standard for RFPAs to take on more work during a fire season this active. When I spoke with Morgan Crom, a rancher and the secretary of the RFPA in Crane, Oregon, and Tom Doman, the association's chairman, they'd just come off a 10-day stretch of back-to-back firefighting. They told me that they'd been working in 36-hour shifts, and when I asked where they'd catch naps during those stretches, in their trucks, Doman clarified, we were not sleeping. The Crane RFPA has already handled 18 fires this year, normally the total they'd have seen by about October. And we still have 90 more days of fire season, Doman said. Fire seasons vary by region, but in general they have been getting longer and less predictable. Both RFPAs and state officials told me that this has made it difficult to get resources when and where they're needed. Typically, Oregon enters into mutual aid agreements with the states in the Southwest and along the East Coast that have different fire seasons and can help one another out. But the whole country has been so dry that they're busy with their own fires, Michael Curran, the chief of fire protection for the Oregon Department of Forestry, told me. RFPAs provide mutual aid to one another too, while members also try to manage their own ranches and farms alongside firefighting. Yesterday, we were moving cows, and the fire was burning right above us, Skinner said, so everybody kind of had an eyeball on it. Some of his grazing land has already burned. Other ranchers have found that their cattle died in the fire. In Jordan Valley, community members have been donating hay to those whose land burned, so their cattle will have something to eat. Rayburn told me that since that terrible 2024 fire season, she has watched landowners for 2 years rebuilding fences and reestablishing water holes and reestablishing their cattle herds. Now the fires are burning those same places, land where families have lived for generations, and land upon which their livelihoods still depend. Our second story. Liberal families are looking pretty traditional. This was written by Joshua Sohn for the Atlantic Magazine on August 21st. What I see in my deep blue D.C. neighborhood undermines the simplistic culture war narrative. Picture an old-fashioned, idealized American scene. Young kids walk to and from a red brick public schoolhouse. Almost every kid's commute is less than 10 minutes. On warm weekend days, the children run lemonade stands, doing brisk business. Their parents host a Christmas tree and baked goods sale on the school field every December, which draws a boisterous crowd. And about those parents, they're almost all married. Divorce and single parenthood are rare. The whole tableau is, at first glance, a social conservative's dream come true. This scene exists in the real world. The neighborhood is my own. The elementary school is my kid's school. But this is no conservative small town. It's an urban neighborhood in Washington, D.C., a city where Kamala Harris beat Donald Trump 90% to 6% in the most recent election. Virtually all of the parents in this neighborhood are highly educated Democrats. Judging from what I see in my community here, these deep blue Washington families are the kinds of families that so many conservatives value. The strong marriages of elite blue America, families whose lives are, in a way, pretty darn conservative, offer a useful counterpoint to the simplistic culture war narrative. Elite blue Americans are an attractive boogeyman for pundits on the right, who regularly write articles about how such people are pushing outre sexual and family values. But when you actually look at these people, you see a lot of folks who get married, have kids, stay married, and live lives that almost seem ripped from a Norman Rockwell painting. As cultural commentator Aaron Wren put it, if you want to see conservative values in practice, you'll often find them among people who vote Democrat and align on the cultural left. Conservatives might benefit from closely observing what's going on here. Liberal Americans achieving what seems to be the conservative goal of stable families. Some social scientists have, in fact, argued that blue values, such as an egalitarianism and secularism, tend to produce stronger marriages than red values, such as religiosity and traditional gender roles. A few data points support their thesis. For example, highly educated Americans are trending blue in their politics, and highly educated Americans are also more likely to be married. As couples move up the educational ladder from high school degree to associate's degree to bachelor's degree to master's degree, the marriage rates keep climbing. But other data paint a different picture. Liberals and Democrats lag behind conservatives and Republicans in marrying and having children, and the gap is growing. As of 2024, among adults aged 30 to 50, Republicans are 18 points more likely than Democrats to be married, and Republican women aged 25 to 35 are 31 points more likely to be mothers. Although delayed marriage and childbearing by Democrats is part of the story, some of the gap is undoubtedly Democrats opting out of marriage and parenthood altogether. Blue values alone don't seem to directly produce stable families. I'll offer this hypothesis instead. At least among many highly educated Democrats, stable families display a mixture of blue and red traits. That's what you see in my neighborhood, as I recently wrote about for the Institute of Family Studies. On the blue egalitarian side, almost every family has two working parents. Stay-at-home moms are scarce. Educational attainment tends to be pretty equal between spouses, and some of the more symbolic lifestyle markers also trend egalitarian. For example, based on the parent lists for many of my kids' classrooms, only 9 kids out of 50, or 18%, have two parents who share a last name. But these families also display some of the more stereotypically red traits, including income hypergamy, meaning that fathers out-earn mothers. In terms of income, there are 3 main career tiers among these well-educated D.C. parents. At the top of the income scale are the private sector for-profit workers. In the middle are government bureaucrats. And at the bottom are the nonprofit NGO workers. Most fathers are in the top or middle tier, while most mothers are in the middle or bottom one. The small number of families with same-sex parents obviously don't show this gender division of income, but they also have two married parents who both work. Why do these couples gravitate toward this gendered income division? Every couple is different, but for many families, this arrangement allows women to pursue career goals beyond remuneration. Excuse me. For example, one of my female colleagues, who is married, has two young kids, separate last names, is working her self-described dream job, prosecuting international money launderers in federal court. Her husband is a law firm partner who makes most of the family's income. My own household is similar. My wife has her dream job as an immunologist at the National Institutes of Health. It's a career path that required several years as a poorly paid postdoc, during which I far out-earned her. In Jane Austen novels, financially advantageous marriages help women secure their social station. But in educated blue America, such marriages help women pursue their career goals while maintaining a household income that can cover the cost of raising kids. Many of these families also have other traditionalist or red-coded markers. For example, many are surprisingly religious. I'd estimate that almost a third of my kids' friends go to church on a weekly basis, mostly in mainline Protestant or Catholic denominations. This might not reach the church-going levels of devout Bible Belt communities, and the mix of churches is definitely different, with evangelical options notably few. But these elite liberals go to church at a higher rate than Americans as a whole. Elite liberals should be proud of their families, and they should preach what they practice. The conservative family scholar Brad Wilcox wasn't wrong when he called it hypocrisy for liberals to publicly promote free-willing family diversity, even while they themselves follow traditional family patterns. Fortunately, some liberals are starting to speak up for the traditional family values, generally out of fashion among liberals. In the past few years, for example, liberal writers such as Nicholas Kristof and center-left scholars such as Melissa Kearney have written about how a stable marriage is the best foundation for raising kids. The preaching, in other words, may be catching up to the practice. Let's hope more people hear it. Next, the AI boom is about to make cars even more expensive. Written by Mateo Wong. New drivers may never have to learn how to parallel park. At least not the old-fashioned way. Many new cars, a Ford Mustang Mach-E, a BMW sedan, a Tesla Cybertruck, will just maneuver into a spot for you with the click of a button. Even a decade-old Toyota Corolla has a backup camera and pedestrian detection. Cars that leave you to park all on your own are a dying breed. Any car manufactured after April 30, 2018, for sale in the United States is legally required to have a backup camera and thus a screen. After all, cars are just computers now. The screen, or really screens, in today's vehicles does a lot more than display rearview footage. It is essentially a tablet wedged into the dashboard that allows you to mirror your phone through Apple CarPlay, make a hands-free call via voice commands, zoom into a work meeting, or even play a video game. Not recommended. Mercedes-Benz debuted a 56-inch display in several models that it calls the hyper screen. But the expectation, and in some cases, the requirement that cars have an ever-growing set of electronic features comes with a cost. Just like laptops, cars depend on microprocessors and random access memory, or RAM, to run all of their computations. There's just a baseline level of tech, and thus a baseline level of cost required of every vehicle. Carl Brower, an executive analyst at IC Cars, that's lowercase I-S-E-E Cars, a automotive research platform, told me. Technology is a major reason the average price of a new car in the U.S. has reached some $50,000, and that was before RAM became the most prized commodities in the world. Artificial intelligence companies are snatching up as much memory as possible for their data centers, causing a memory shortage that has significantly raised the prices of phones, laptops, and just about any consumer electronic device. Cars are next. The problem runs much deeper than a screen. Cars started morphing into computers in the 1970s, when new emission standards made electronic systems necessary to manage ignition and fuel injection. There's been a gradual software creep ever since. Power windows, adaptive cruise control, anti-lock brakes. Regulators now rate cars based not just on how they do during a crash, but also how well their electronic safety systems avoid a crash. We've evolved every single component of the vehicle to involve a semiconductor, Ivan Drury, the director of insights at Edmunds, told me. More recently, Tesla in particular has played a big role in pushing the auto industry to stuff vehicles with even more digital technology. Whereas pistons and fuel lines make a gas-powered car move, electric vehicles are run by a computer that regulates their battery and motor. It's no coincidence that Tesla helped popularize the giant in-car touchscreen. Today's new cars, electronic or otherwise, have driver assistance features, receive over-the-air software updates, can even load ChatGPT. BMW advertises the ability to have a distinct climate control setting for every passenger, and the option to install screens into back seats, airplane style. In most vehicles on American roads, all of this software is controlled by hundreds of separate electronic units throughout the car. Features such as anti-lock brakes and lane detection sensors don't need all that much processing power, and they can be operated by chips that might account for 5 to 10% of a vehicle's materials cost. Sam Abulsamid, an analyst at Telemetry and a former automotive engineer, told me. Again, following the lead of EV startups such as Tesla and Rivian, legacy automakers are shifting from these ad hoc tiny control units to one or two big computers that run all of the software in their vehicles, and in turn require much more RAM. These central computers allow for a streamlined supply chain, seamless software updates, and a faster internet connection. Plus, as General Motors advertises, they will be ready for future AI workloads. You can't really build a car that safely and reliably that drives itself with a collection of puny computer chips. Such centralized computers need more advanced automotive microprocessors from NVIDIA or Qualcomm, and might eventually account for 20% or more of a vehicle's cost, Abulsamid said. That was before the AI-fueled memory shortage. In other words, cars are becoming more software-heavy and dependent on memory chips than ever, right when those chips are in high demand from tech companies willing to pay premiums that automakers cannot afford. Over the next year, the memory shortage, sometimes known as Ramageddon, will likely raise vehicle prices by a few percentage points on average, Abulsamid said. The relative amount would be smaller than the shocking double-digit jumps for gaming consoles and MacBooks, but in some ways more significant. A 4% hike for cars amounts to some $2,000 on average. Cars with those centralized computers will be affected the most, but no vehicle will be spared. Even if you don't need the high-end chips, you're going to pay more even for the low-end chips just because of the supply constraint, Abdelsamad said. On a recent earnings call, Ford's chief financial officer said that the company has paid $1 billion in higher materials costs due to the memory shortage and inflation. GM and Volkswagen, too, have noted rising chip costs to investors. Ramageddon is poised to last for several years, but the consequences for car buyers may be permanent. Consider what happened during the pandemic, when supply chain disruptions and rising demand for electronics produced a major chip shortage. Nearly every major car company had to slash production because they simply couldn't procure enough chips, and shifted their focus to selling higher-end and higher-profit vehicles. Potential customers already willing to spend six figures on a car are much less likely to care about a 5 or 10% price hike, Drury said. Even now, car companies are continuing to focus on selling more profitable models. Since the pandemic, the average price of a new vehicle has jumped $11,000. The AI-fueled chip crisis could play out more severely. The average price of a new car could, before long, jump to $60,000 and beyond. These rising costs are making cars even more similar to computers and all of the software they run. Perhaps in an effort to mitigate higher prices, some automakers are also introducing in-car advertisements and putting certain features such as heated seats behind a paywall. As cars have morphed into computers, the inevitable next step is for automakers to behave like modern tech companies. Most Americans cannot afford a $60,000 new car, let alone a $50,000 one. When new vehicle prices soar, the used car market follows. That has been one durable consequence of the pandemic's chip crisis. The average price of a three-year-old used car is up $9,000, or nearly 40%, since before the pandemic. To get the same prices, Americans already have to buy much older cars that have far more miles on them. If automakers continue to shift their focus to designing cars with more software, more screens, more self-driving features, that increasingly prices people out of even the used vehicle market, Abdelsamad said. It's one thing for the AI industry's appetite for memory chips to raise the price of an Xbox or even a new laptop, but the stakes are much more consequential when it becomes harder and more expensive to go get groceries, pick up the kids from school, and go to work. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Please join us next time. We hope you've enjoyed listening. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.